What's up, guys? I'm Meg, and it's all just
a bunch of hocus pocus.
You're listening to The Millennial Rewatcher. My dudes. So, motherfucker.
Why is it being weird? Hang on. Technical difficulties already.
Oh, if this cord is starting to eat shit, it's definitely just a bunch of hocus pocus up in here. Fuck.
What is your problem, computer cord?
I put a spell on you, bitch. Okay, well, I'm probably cutting all of that audio, but I don't have an opening for you guys. We're gonna go straight to the movie today. I've had a rough time of it. Just the past week and a half, I've been sick. When I can't keep myself at some sort of baseline, okay, my tendency to flip into a rabbit hole spiral of an autistic meltdown, it comes on real fast. And when I'm not at some sort of baseline, okay, which a base, the world is in an entire one honking chunk of something just existing in it. It's honkiness. What the fuck? That's a worst metaphor ever. Whatever, we're rolling with it because I got nothing today. I'm always in some sort of elevated existence of sensory overload, which is just a huge part of my life as a neurodivergent person. It affects everything. So if that is not in some sort of okay semblance of balance, even though that balance is still out of balance a little bit for me, everything gets skyrocketed into a troublesome area. And I don't know if that makes any sort of sense, but that's because I've been sick. I was traveling and I wanted to talk about that experience traveling. I don't know if I'm going to, because I wanted not the traveling itself, but the event that I went to, and my brain got flipped upside down with a learning experience I wasn't prepared for. And like, you know, you can't always be prepared for those kinds of things. Of course not. It's asinine to think that one could be. But I, in my head, I think that I'm supposed to be able to prepare for those things. And when I can't, it's a whole other duress thing. I don't know. I'm such an over-explainer. I have to over-explain to myself as well. So that's what part of that is. But I had a immersive learning experience regarding the big ass fucking attachments I latch onto with people. And I guess in sort of more so the parasocial relationship realm of my existence, with the thing I went to, that my tendency to do that was upended.
Are you still listening? Am I boring you yet?
Maybe, I don't know. But anyways, my point is, if any of this is making sense, is that I learned a lot of things about this person that I had formed a very intense attachment to. And that attachment was something I thought I needed to exist, needed to succeed, needed to hold on to for dear fucking life. Because I also thought that it was something, a relationship that could potentially boost my own capabilities within the podcasting world and visibility. I thought it was a relationship that I should garner. When I become that immersed into a one-sided relationship, whatever the context is and source of the relationship, whether it's parasocial or not, it's usually to my own detriment. And it usually ends up suffocating me and holding me back from my own potential. But I wasn't seeing that until this experience. As a woman in an autistic neurodivergent brain, from my understanding and a lot of the reading I've done, because this is my experience, so it's become my special fucking interest. So listen, I'm not just talking out my ass here. I'm not an expert. I'm not trying to purport myself as such, but one of the commonly seen happenstances, characteristics, I'm not finding the right word to describe this, of the autistic ADHD experience in women is these intense bonds that we create to people, whether it be a person in our community, our actual day-to-day life, social life, online, a celebrity, whatever. It's just one of the things that sometimes we do, and I do that a lot. I mean, my entire podcast is fucking about that. And when those illusions are shattered, it's unnerving and it's hard to deal with, because then it makes me feel bad about myself. It makes me feel like there's something wrong with me. And then when that illusion is shattered, specifically with this person, because I thought it was, even though it was much more parasocial than I realized, I thought it was still something special, because I thought in the long run that if they could just see my potential, then they would be able to help me take myself to places I don't think that I'm ever going to be able to get to on my own. And then this event happened and I learned so many things, and it showed me that I need to work on this more. But that's also part of the reason why I'm here, and that's why I'm talking about it right now. So, you know, if you wanted to skip forward, I don't know. If this isn't your experience and you don't get it, I can't, you know, it is what it is. If you don't want to listen to it, I just needed to get it out because it's been bothering me and it's hindered my ability to function. Because I just take time to process things much longer than I realized. And I used to feel really guilty about too. So I don't have any pre-movie facts for you. I am doing Hocus Pocus 2, not 1, but 2. And I'm doing the second one because I love the first one so much, like any millennial 90s kid. I mean, not just millennials and 90s kids. This movie is beloved by a many. But there's a certain generation, because it came out in 93, that we're just a little more attached to it, maybe. And again, that's not to say that others aren't. I couldn't watch this movie when it first came out. It came out in 2002, so last year. There had been rumors of a Hocus Pocus 2 starting back in, I think, 2014. You know, things floating about of the main cast coming together again for this, you know, up for the roles, things like that. And then it finally happened and it came out in 2002, and 3% of me was like, oh my god, this is fucking amazing. But the rest was like, I can't handle watching this. I can't do it. And I don't even fully have the words for that. Besides, again, I guess I felt like watching it, I was gonna lose something. I don't know. Like, I couldn't face the bond. Of course I'm crying. I don't know. I couldn't face the bond of this the original movie. Again, it comes on in like a, I feel like I'm grieving something and I'm gonna lose something, and it's like this it's like I'm, I don't know, sitting on the brink of a crumbling cliff, and the anticipation of falling is so intense I can't take it. But it's funny, when I got home from that trip I went on recently, the next morning I had a dentist appointment. When I came home, my kids, they're old enough to be home on their own, so I didn't just like leave them here, but anyways, they had just started watching Hocus Pocus 2, and I sat down and watched it with them. There maybe was a minor hesitation, but I think I was just so full of processing emotions. And then I fucking hate going to the dentist. It's never fun. And I watched it. Facing this movie and actually watching it was something that I had been considering doing for the podcast, for the Millennial Rewatcher, when I started it, because I had already, when I started it, I skipped forward a little bit to this time of year because I knew there was going to be movies that were just going to be fun to rewatch and recap, and less of my heavy hitter trauma bond bullshit thingies. But then I was like, oh god, I wonder if I could do this. I wonder if I could face this movie and watch it and then talk about it and work through it in that way. Because again, I don't know if doing this helps anyone else, even just listening to me dribble on in my own way. But I guess that's what I really want. I'm fucking shaking. I wish I had more clinical words to describe why I get so worked up like this. But I think it just goes back to, this is how intensely my I don't fully understand it, but this is how intensely my body will form attachments to pop culture, movies, celebrities, people who aren't actually in my life. And then you just add it to everything that's going on in the world, and all this fucking devastation, and then just my everyday life and how difficult it is to even stay at like a baseline okay for what's okay for me, and then the depression and guilt that comes with that. Anyways, we're doing Hocus Pocus 2.
Hey, it's the Sanderson sisters. All right, looking good. I bet you're looking for the stage.
Always.
It was made by Disney. It's on Disney Plus, unless you want to go purchase it. It was directed by Anne Fletcher. The screenplay was by Jen D'Angelo. The story was written by David Kirshner, Blake Harris, and Jen D'Angelo. Of course, we have Bette Midler back as Winnie Sanderson. Taylor Paige Henderson plays the young Winnie that we'll meet in the beginning. Sarah Jessica Parker is back as Sarah Sanderson. And Juju Brunner plays young Sarah Sanderson. Kathy Najimy plays Mary Sanderson, and Nina Kitchen plays our young Mary Sanderson. Then we have Sam Richardson, who plays Gilbert, one of my faves. He works at the old Salem magic shop. That is the witch's house. Used to be, anyway. And Jalen Pryor plays teen Gilbert, because we get some flashbacks where you see a young Gilbert. All right, one of our, or our only other besides the witches, role reprisals is played by Doug Jones, who plays William Billy Butcherson. Then we have Whitney Peake as Becca. Belisa Escobedo plays Izzy. Lilia Buckingham plays Cassie Trask. Tony Hale plays Jeffrey Trask. He's the mayor of Salem in present day and also Cassie's father. So he also plays Reverend Trask, which will meet in the beginning of the film. There's a little bit of a crossover role there, and he's kind of fabulous in his ridiculousness. Hannah Waddingham plays Mother Witch, who is a mysterious and sinister witch who gifts book to the young Sanderson sisters. We have Froy Gutierrez as Mike. I really hope I said that one right. I tried. I did my thing where I looked it up, but you know. Okay, and then we have to mention in one of the scenes during the festival in this film, before we get one of the witches' musical interludes, we see some drag queens from RuPaul's Drag Race.
Hello, hello, hello! Congratulations, ladies. For today's mini challenge, you need to give face, face, face while the pit crew blows you. With a leaf blower.
Damn.
Oh, pit crew.
I'm from Florida. I have survived many a hurricane, but never one that's been blowing me right in the mouth.
So they are alums, and there's Ginger Minge, who plays Winnie. Cornbread Jeté, is that how you say that? I'm so sorry. I love you. Who, I believe, plays Mary. And then Kimora Hall plays Sarah. And that's, again, during the festival, and they're playing the Sanderson sisters during the Sanderson costume contest. This movie, it opens with this huge black bird flying over OG Salem, circa 1693. I keep on wanting to switch the 6 and the 9 and that around. Incorrect. This bird has some red and I think a little bit of yellow coloring on it that reminds me of the vest that the flying monkeys wear in The Wizard of Oz. It's not wearing a vest, it's just part of its feathers. But I saw it and I go, is this like a hybrid witchy black bird? I don't know if it's a raven or a crow or what, but it's huge. And it so in my brain, I fused it with the flying monkey. My camera zooms from this bird that's flying over Massachusetts and Salem to a young Winnie Sanderson stomping through town. So sorry if my voice goes in and out. I had to get this out on time. So it is what it is. Winnie is big steamed because some Puritan bitch just demanded that she marry because apparently she's getting old. It's her 16th birthday.
That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
It's Halloween. We learned that her birthday's on Halloween, which is cool as fuck. Ew, the Puritan idea that 16 is old. Actual physical vomit. So sorry. And I guess this reverend, Puritan reverend bitch, is sort of responsible for her and her sisters because they're orphans. So that's why he's trying to tell her what to do. But I have a feeling he would try to tell her what to do no matter what. But anyways, she told him to F off in 1600s profanity. She's real proud of herself for that. She heads back home where Sarah made a jello mold for her. And Mary colored it with, I think, animal blood. And they're so proud of this. I adore it. And you also see that Mary is wearing this hat that is sort of the shape of a witch hat, but it's not quite a witch hat. It just kind of has this weird twist to it. And it's white and it kind of has that cuff around it that's a little more like a bonnet. That doesn't make sense, but you know. But I was clocking that because then later on when you see Mary, and of course, if you kind of conjure your brain images back to the image of Mary in Hocus Pocus 1, her hair looks like that. And I go, oh, I like how they did that. That little connection there of before they turned full witch and were outcast by the Puritans, she just had this bonnet looking thing. And then now her hair is the... Anyways, I just liked it. So Winnie's telling them about the interaction with the Puritan bitch demanding she marry. The sisters give her a gift. It's this freaky ass spider.
Would thee like to open thy present? You will love it.
And then there's a knock at the door. When he tries to hide, she's like, hide, pretend we're not here. So Mary and Sarah jump on the bed because it's just this big open room in this cabin. Except Sarah, in true Sarah fashion, yells, no one's home. And Winnie's like, fucking shit, Sarah. God damn it.
Hide. Act as if we're not here.
Open the door.
We're not here.
It's the Reverend asshole and the entire town ready to smite Witty unless she agrees to marry John Pritchard. I swear, was everyone named John back then? Yes. Also, why? Winnie says, fuck that. Has some choice words for the Reverend, who is all huffy and puffy and just, how dare thee. Some woman even says, you can't talk to a man like that. I would love to flick her in her bulbous nose. So the Reverend is, you know, ready to smite. And he's like, well, fine. I've already made arrangements for the Smiths, who are going to take Sarah and Mary. And this is an exact quote. Turn them right.
Never repeat this to anyone that you respect, okay?
What the fuck does that even mean? I can imagine what it means, but I hate it. I hate it so much. Winnie's losing it. The sisters are losing it. It's kind of chaos here. And then Winnie's spider gift gets loose. And it must hate the Puritans too, because it goes after the Reverend, who's losing his ever-loving Puritan mind.
Eight legs of sin!
He's screaming things like Satan's pet and eight legs of sin. And then someone else is screaming, they tried to kill him. No, the spider was just like, dude, you're a big ass bitch. And I'm gonna make you feel like a big ass bitch. So now the sisters get big banished and they escape to the Forbidden Wood. They're doing this calming circle, which is hilarious because it's just them conjuring up thoughts of macabre things to calm themselves. They're like, spiders, Satan's pet, you know? And then we start to hear this kind of trickle of Sarah's kid killing lullaby as that bird comes back and it flies in and transforms into a human. This woman is stunning. When she popped into her human form, I was like, holy shit. You are fucking beautiful. Can I have an outfit like that? I don't know if I'd want to be a bird. No, I'd want to be a bat. But if I get to be a witch, can I also transform into a bat minus the rabies part? Can we just nix that? Can we just put that into the, you know, whatever spell I need to say no rabies. P.S. No rabies. Okay. So she does initially attempt to eat them, you know, by sucking their life force out of them. But she detects that they are different and stops. And then she explains why the woods are feared. It's sacred to witches. And she uses it to hunt and suck the youth from kids. And then we meet the book. Book!
Magic has a way of uniting things that ought to be together. Happy 16th birthday, child.
But I'm a witch. I know things. Go on.
I love this line that she says. She says, magic has a way of uniting things that ought to be together. And I just really love that line. It felt really special. So Winnie and the sisters are elated over book. They see this spell for Maxicum? This is not some sex ritual spell. Maximum power. And the bird witch makes them promise to never use it because initially Winnie is like, oh shit, I want to do this spell. I'ma earmark that one. Someone get me a post-it. Mother witch, she says, absolutely fucking not. Don't you ever put your little witchy hands on that spell and those words in your witchy ass mouth, because it ain't gonna be good. So they promise to never use it. She leaves, and then the sisters proceed to use the book, minus that one spell, to get revenge on the town, and it's pretty sweet.
Word up!
Now they shall never take us! Now we'll be together forever!
Satan's work, Eric! Throw the water! Oh, this is the work of the spider! Can you feel it? It's all around us! It's evil!
I think the Reverend even blames the spider. Okay. You realize that there's spiders everywhere, right? Side note, as I've been working through my trauma and relearning myself as an ADHD autistic person, I used to have a big ass fear of spiders, even the small ones. And I'm not totally cured of this. Like, please don't crawl at me. I'm not trying to get a pet spider. I'd still prefer to not see it. But for some reason, I'm not nearly as terrified of spiders anymore. Like, if there's one in the room, even a big-ass one, I'll just be like, I mean, what's up? I'd prefer if you just went back into hiding. But, like, I guess you're here now, so it's chill. And I don't kill them anymore. I'll capture them and set them free, even the big ones. Who am I? Is that, like, a healed trauma thing? I don't know. But anyways, now we're going to jump to present-day Salem. I was just a little ghoul when I heard his name. He's the graveyard legend of the dancing game. Rumor has it he invented how to knock him dead. He's the reason that we all say break a leg. When the sun goes down, all the ghosts come out. Zombies rise up from the ground. Monsters come from all the lands. Just to see the bones on skeleton sand. We jump to what I'm assuming is, you know, Salem High School, whatever the fuck they call it. And we meet these three friends. Well, we're introduced to them. Becca, Izzy, and Cassie. We see Becca first and then Izzy and then we'll meet Cassie. But anyways, it's Halloween and it's Becca's 16th birthday. Happy birthday! There's some animosity between the three of them. You can instantly pick up on it. Mainly between Cassie and then Becca and Izzy. Essentially, Cassie got a boyfriend and they don't like her boyfriend. And I have a lot of things to say about the writing of this whole situation and their, I guess, drama. The very neurodivergent traits that are used to write Mike's character and paint him as a town idiot bad guy. So I might harp on that a bit, but I do this with everything. It's not just this film. I get really worked up when I see, because I see it a lot in books, TV shows, movies, neurodivergent traits used to create the guy or girl or whomever that you hate, the villain, the bad guy, the antagonist. And then the neurodivergence is just about never pointed out. And if it is, they're still painted in a real bad light. And I'm not saying I say that all the time when there's a presence of neurodivergence, but it's very common or it's tokenized. And it just pisses me off because, again, as a kid, I consumed so much pop culture. I read literally all the time. And if at one point anything I was reading actually said the actual thing that this person was struggling with or had, it could have changed the course of my fucking life. And it's no one else's responsibility in that sense. I understand that. But it infuses my body with such spite and anger that people openly use neurodivergence to prop up their plot lines and stories and characters in whatever negative or possibly negative, not always negative, but a lot of times negative ways, and don't actually say what the fuck it is. Anyways, clearly it traps my ass. Okay, so yeah, sorry. Let's get back to this. I'm sorry. Am I though? I don't know. You're easily picking up on there being, you know, some fissure between Cassie and Becca and Izzy, and they used to be, you know, real tight best friends all their lives. They've grown up together. They sort of bring up this birthday ritual thing that they usually do, but then they're interrupted by Cassie's boyfriend, Mike. Becca and Izzy, they treat Mike like shit, and I'm going to play some audio clips of their dialogue so you can get a better representation of what I'm talking about, and I'll break it down a little bit.
Birthday ritual, scary movie marathon, same as every year, you know?
Yeah.
Hey, Faith, sorry I'm late. I decided to have two breakfasts. Oh, and you gotta come check out Ryan's car. We covered the entire thing in tinfoil.
Why?
Because it's funny.
One of the things I've learned about myself is that I can be very good, not all the time, and again, I am not a professional. If I had learned these things about myself sooner, I might have gone into psychology because I'm very good at picking up the patterns of human behavior, not patterns in general, but human behavior, characteristics, incidences, whatever. So you can see by the way that Mike is interacting with them, there's a lightheartedness to him, and it's coming off as he thinks that he's handling these social interactions that are outside of the bounds of his comfortability correctly, and that he's picking up on social cues correctly, which fuck social cues. The idea of what a social cue is itself is different to everyone, especially, you know, between neurotypical neurodivergence. But honestly, the way that Becca and Izzy respond to Mike is so neurotypical, I can't stand it.
$10 says we have a pop quiz today.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Cassie. About tonight, I was...
Dude, it's gonna be awesome.
What is?
Our party at Cassie's. You're coming, right? We invited the whole grade, even Glenn. Yo, Glenn! Glenn! What? So, Glenn.
You're throwing a party tonight?
How is that even possible? Your dad would never let you do that.
It was my idea.
I told you I wanted to talk to him about it first.
Oh, do you guys want to talk now?
No, it's fine. We don't have anything to talk about.
I mean, they're also teenagers and their communication just sucks because the problems that these three girls have between another, they're not actually talking about it. They're just assuming that everyone kind of understands what's happening and they're still not talking about it. So they're not being clear with their feelings and it's creating more problems in in their communication and their friendship. And they're teenagers. So, like, I mean, you know, we got to give them some space to forgive that. And I don't need to remind myself of that. But anyways, they all head to class. And Becca is talking about how she's sure there's going to be a pop quiz. And Mike is all like, oh my God, I hope there isn't because I didn't study. And Becca side-eyes him like he's the dumbest person she's ever encountered. I'm probably relating to Mike too much here, but that sounds like something that I would say and on the inside die of cringe because it would come out before I fully heard it.
Have fun at your party.
Becca, come on.
Are you guys going to be busy doing witchery? What? The three of you used to do witch stuff every Halloween.
It's not witch stuff.
And what's that?
A good luck charm in case there's a pop quiz.
Well, I hope not, because I didn't do the reading.
When I was in middle school, we were in the cafeteria, it was lunchtime, and I was sitting down at one of the tables, and I had off and on a group of friends, and I realized now that they weren't actually my friends. I think they just put up with me. But for some reason, I can't remember why, one of them had my little carton of milk. I think we'd all kind of been in line to get our trays and, you know, somehow they ended up with my carton of milk. And bitch, I used to fuck up some dairy. I loved me my milk. So in my head, real quick, before I heard it out loud, I thought it would be real funny and get a good laugh and some like positive attention to, you know, throw my hand out on the table and just yell, milk me, so they could slide the milk down and I could catch it. But when I said it, everyone laughed and they were like, oh, because you're a cow. And I was really overweight, which is fine. But again, I'm a millennial and not that kids aren't just as cruel, if not more today. But the bullies were real and they took that as an opportunity to make fun of me so hard. But some of the girls also just looked at me like, why the fuck would you even say that? I don't know. I just did. So anyways, again, I'm probably relating to Mike too much here and I need to remove myself a bit. Again, I have a hard time not going to bat for unrecognized, undiagnosed neurodivergence. And I want everyone to understand. And this just reminded me of that, so I'm sorry. To me, clearly, Mike struggles with social cues. He's very socially awkward outside of what is comfortable for him. And he's comfortable within sports. And even within that, I don't think he's fully comfortable. But aside from that, he just, I don't know. So anyways, the teacher walks in this banana costume. Very dry, but like in a banana costume. And the contrast is funny. And he's like, hey, y'all, time for a pop quiz. So Mike says,
you knew that was going to happen.
Mr. Wilkie's a jerk. Of course he'd give us a pop quiz on Halloween. I made an inference.
Is that a spell?
And Becca thinks he's being a jerk. So she decides that she's going to spook him.
Say that!
What did you do? Everyone, settle down. She was muttering some weird, scary language.
Mike gets genuinely freaked out here. There's like a little bit of chaos here. And he's like, what the fuck? How did you know that? Oh my God. And also, I think that he's just not recognizing that he's being louder than he thinks he is. And he's genuinely freaked out. And he doesn't really know how to handle that. But if you listen to the way he talks, I swear it's not coming off as mocking or rude. But Becca's taking it that way. And I'm not saying that one side is like more correct than the other. It just, I wish that we were more educated even as kids on these things. Say that this character is neurodivergent. If he had that understanding of himself, it might be easier to cope in these types of situations. And if we also just we're more attuned to the human brain and the different types of ways that the human brain operates, and weren't so stuck in this very neurotypical capitalistic education way of learning mindset, then these situations might be different. God, I just keep going off. Becca tries to deny that she was doing anything. She flips from like playing this prank on him to denying it real fast, and which also pisses me off. And she kind of turns to Cassie to back her up, but Cassie's like, okay, but you did actually just say those things. And so she feels like she's being put in a position of defending her friend or her boyfriend, and it's not fair because Becca just wants her to lie for her at the expense of her boyfriend, and that's fucked. It's just like if she said to Mike, hey, the way you're talking to me and the way I hear you talk to other people makes me feel bad, and he was still a jerk, that'd be one thing. But she doesn't do that, and again, they're teenagers, and you know, that's just a whole another conversation, I guess. But we'll learn later that Mike really didn't know that he was rubbing people the wrong way when he was trying to relate to them, have a social interaction with people, again, outside of his social comfortabilities, if that makes sense. He thought he was socially interacting appropriately. So they get sent to the principal's office. Cassie shows up when Mike is in the office and Becca is in the hallway waiting. I don't know if she's already been seen by the principal or waiting her turn. Either way, Becca starts lecturing Cassie about this Halloween party that Cassie's going to have without her dad's permission that night. Mike comes out. He announces that he's got detention. For fucking what? For fucking what? For Becca playing a prank on him? I'm sorry, I need to stop. Anyways, they go their separate ways. Outside, Izzy and Becca pass by the Halloween festival being set up, and we learn that Cassie is the mayor's daughter, and her family dates back to the Salem witch trials. So Cassie's dad, his bloodline traces back to the bitch-ass Reverend Trask, I believe his name was, that banished Winnie, Sarah, and Mary, which is important. So remember that. They run into Cassie's dad, who pushes a bunch of these re-election flyers on them to hand out, and he's gushing about these candy apples that he's super thrilled to have back at the festival this year and how much he can't wait to have one.
Yeah. I'm gonna see you at the festival tonight. Look at this. Am I gonna see you here? Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's gonna be a good one, because guess why? Guess who's coming back from Boston? Sandy's Candy Cauldron. What? You remember Sandy's Candy Cauldron? Oh, come on, she was the best. And then she got so busy because she went on something called GMA, which is like some acronym for fancy people. I don't really get it, but you know.
Good morning, America.
So now Becca and Izzy are going to head to the magic shop that they frequented for as long as, you know, it's been around. And they've been living there so since they were kids. Which is, I could have just said since they were kids, but whatever. So this magic shop is the house that used to be the Sanderson sisters' house. And we meet Gilbert. I adore Gilbert. I'm assuming he owns the shop. At the very least, he operates it and such. There's this crowd of kids and parents in costumes, and they're having a sort of story time, and he's telling the story of the Sanderson sisters. The legend, if you will. We also see Book locked in a glass case held down by leather straps. Gilbert gifts Becca a candle and says,
"Legend has it, it's on the 16th birthday that a witch gets her power."
I love Becca's response.
"And like most legends, I'm assuming that's based in some sort of patriarchal fear of female aging."
And Gilbert's like, "You can use the candle for your birthday ritual." Now Becca and Izzy, they head to the Forbidden Wood, the setting that Becca has chosen for the ritual that year. They light the candle Gilbert gave Becca and begin to chant.
Another year begins anew, maiden, mother, and crone too. We call on thee with one request. Help our intentions manifest.
You won't go out. Thanks a lot, Gilbert. Almost started a forest fire.
The candle goes all nuts and they put it out with some water, which works for a moment until the candle relights and it's the black flame candle. What the fuck, Gil?
What the?
This is where I start calling Gilbert Gil. Sorry, but I'm not. I like it. I adore Gilbert, even though he done fucked up making this candle. Because we learn that he makes the candle himself and he's been trying to bring the witches back ever since he was a kid. But anyways, more on that later. They hear a whisper of Sarah's kid luring song for a moment, and then the earth starts to quake and shake. And then split.
No!
And then the sisters are back.
Lock up your children! Yes, Salem, we're back!
I do love this moment when you see them come out of the woods, puff into existence with their shimmery colors of purple and, what is it, blue and green? What color is Mary? Shoot, I'm blanking. Anyways, I think that's it. Regardless, it's all shimmery and misty and dark and magical. And of course, they just are the three of them together. It's instantly them again. And their chemistry and the way they just slipped back into the roles of these women, the Sanderson sisters, is in itself. It feels so good and right, and it gets me excited. I do just want to note, I was hoping to see more of the original cast worked into the sequel, into the script. I did see a bit about Thora Birch, who played Dani, at some point was written into the script, I believe, but there was, you know, that age-old comment of scheduling conflicts, and she wasn't able to film with them. I would have really loved, because she was so young, I really would have loved to see her come back. I don't know what that would have looked like, but come back as something. The other original character is the guy who plays Billy Butcherson, which I know I already said, but anyways, that's kind of it. We don't see anyone else from the original film, which I don't know. I guess it isn't necessary. There's just something about that that I think would have brought this together a little bit more. And maybe I'm wrong, but that's just how I feel about it. Of course, they immediately break into song.
We were running wild and so reviled, raising Cain until we got exiled. But times are changing, now we're on the attack. Yeah, the spell is gonna hit ya, cause the witches are back.
What do we do?
I don't know, but I literally can't stop watching them.
Honestly, I find their musical interludes a bit much. It is cringy, but I also kind of feel like we're in on the cringe, like it's intentional. And I don't know if they were leaning too much into that because there is some kind of so good it's bad cringy moments in the original Hocus Pocus, which wasn't originally supposed to be more of the comedy witchy thing. It was supposed to be a darker film, but as it was cast and some things changed along the way, I think what it turned into, this kind of campy, witchy Halloween film, is exactly what it needed to be. So I feel like they're trying to grab onto that a little bit too much with some of these musical interludes. But at the same time, I kind of feel like we're in on it, because even the girls in the scene as they're running away are like, who the hell are they performing for? Why are they still singing? And then Sarah pops out.
Who are they performing for?
You!
They attempt to get at Becca and Izzy's youthful life force, but the girls convince them that they aren't kids. They're like, yeah, so we're actually 40 and youthful because we also eat kids' life forces, and that's why we were in the woods.
This time, if we see a teenager, we will kill it!
Wait, we're not teenagers. No, we only look young, but really, we're 40?
40? Ooh, 40. Old folks, huh?
Fine physician.
I must say.
It's so quiet.
They're aged.
Yeah, I mean, we eat young souls all the time. That's, huh? We're just like you guys. That's why we brought you back. You are our idols.
My favorite word.
Guess what? You don't need potions anymore. You can just buy them, because they try to call for the book. But remember, the book is in its glass case under lock and key. It can't get out. So they're stressed. And then that's when the girls are like, they come prepackaged, bitch. So they go to Walgreens. This is probably my favorite scene, perhaps. Especially Sarah trying to pass through these automatic doors. It's like... It's like me trying to go through one of those revolving doors, because they stress me out. I don't like them. I feel like I'm going to be smashed by them or eaten or, I don't know, taken to another realm. And I know I won't be, but I feel like it's going to happen.
Winnie, the gates, they parted for her.
Oh, she must be very powerful.
Mm. Well, so am I.
Careful.
I'm just gonna
go to it. Okay, I'll give it a try. Oh,
the scene is fucking hilarious. Although when they start drinking body lotions and face creams. Mary takes a big old chunk of the bat out of the face sheet mask.
Look, it is the face of a child.
A newborn.
Oh, sister. What does it taste like?
Raspberry.
Sarah at one point says, retinol, what a nice name. As if it's got like the kid's name on it because it's got a soul in it.
No.
Oh, retinol. What a charming name for a child.
So yeah, their commentary fucking kills me. While this is happening, the girls are stressed, but the witches are definitely keeping an eye on them. They keep kind of popping out just when they think they're going to slink off.
I love that. It works every time. So, where on earth are you two delicious morsels going?
Nowhere. No, not running away. We're just giving you some space.
Oh, no, I don't want space. Oh, come on, my friends, let's get closer. Closer, right? So I can be close enough, just in case I decide to eat you. Soup's on, shall we? Dinner for three.
So the girls are like, all right, so we need salt for protection. Let's stock up. So Izzy does manage to slink off to grab some while Becca stays with the sisters. Eventually, the sisters figure out that there are no souls of children in the Walgreens products, go after the girls, but they use the salt to create a protective shield and they get the fuck out of there. So the sisters are like, fuck, we do actually have to get the fucking book. Book! When he's like, sisters, we must fly. But I guess even Walgreens only has one broom. Which Winnie, of course, takes for herself. So here's the lineup. One broom. One Swiffer wet jet loaded with soap. And two Roombas for Mary, each for 1 foot.
Winnie! My groomies are misbehaving! Uh-oh! Winnie! I'm surfing, cowabunga!
When I'm holy dance off, I'll do it!
They were the only broomies left! The man said, be careful, they have a mind of their own. He's right.
Becca and Izzy go back to Gil's shops. We're at the magic shop again. And they see that the book is awake because now it's little eye flap. Blech, why did I say it like that? Its eye is open as where it was closed before. You know, it was in slumber. Gil is thrilled. My dude is ecstatic. And he takes the book out of its case.
Hey, remember me? Yeah, it's Gilbert. Well, Gilbert the Great, because I burned the title now with my knowledge of magical and the occult.
We learn that Gil has been trying to bring the witches back and the candle he gave Becca. Well, he made that shit. But he needed someone else to light it because Gil ain't no virgin. The sisters show up now.
At last, back to our squalid permanent abode. Home sweet.
No. Where are all the cobwebs? And my rat tails. Uh-oh. Winnie, hold me. Oh, it no longer smells like death. Now it smells like...
clean linen. Yeah, we have a plug-in for that.
A boy.
Hi, I'm Gilbert the Great, and I am your biggest fan.
Gil! He really says, hi, I'm Gilbert the Great. I'm your biggest fan. Mary sees Becca and Izzy and says, I found the two 40-year-old teenagers. Honestly, this movie is fucking hilarious. Even at this point, I can't say I love it like the first one, but it does have some hilarious moments in writing. I have a bone to pick with the writers on the whole neurodivergent thing with Mike and the conflict between the friends, but you know, I already went off on that a lot, so I'm gonna try to reel it back in. But also, cringe can just be fun, okay? If you're not into that, that's fine, but that doesn't mean it's wrong. Gil does get kind of protective over the girls when he sees the witches going after them, but what the fuck did you think was gonna happen, Gil? You know the legend so well, what the fuck did you think was gonna happen here, okay? We learn some more about Gil's thing with the witches. He was there in 93, and we get this flashback to him happening upon the graveyard when the sisters poofed out of existence. And after that, in 93, he went straight to the shop, which was more of like a gift shop and less of the magic shop, and it had been shut down for a while, you know, if you remember the 93 film. And he found book, and he's been using it to try to recreate the black flame candle for quite some time. So it took him a lot of tries, I guess. He ain't a natural born witch, or is it, would it be warlock? Doesn't matter. I don't know. A person with magical abilities. Now the sisters see a campaign flyer for the mayor and recognize him as a descendant of that Reverend Puritan bitch. So they decide, instead of making a potion to suck the youth from kids, that it's time to use the Maximus power spell that they swore not to use, and they end up cursing Gilbert into helping them.
You shall gather all the ingredients and bring them to the Forbidden Wood. And we shall sniff out the blood of our enemy.
The Reverend.
The Reverend there. And if you fail, you forfeit your life. With the last grain
of this sand.
Best of luck, Gilbert.
Oh, and Wilbert, I made thee a list. Thy life depends upon it.
Gil is like, how the fuck am I going to pull this off? Especially because the ingredient list on this potion that they're going to need to make to do this whole power Maximus blah, blah, blah spell includes the head of a lover, of an ex-lover. So he's like, how the fuck am I going to pull this off? But then he remembers, oh yeah, Winnie's ex-lover is buried in the graveyard. That's right. It's time for Billy Butcherson.
Who are you?
Zombie! Killer zombie!
Stop! I am a good zombie. I'm not even chasing thee.
Stay back!
And don't try to eat my brains.
Why would I? I simply wish to know why you were digging up my grave.
Billy Butcherson is a standout in this film for me. Him and Gil, their friendship is cool as shit. We're going to get into it, but I just get ecstatic over it. I loved Billy from the first film. He's even more hilarious in this one. And it turns out that Billy's been awake in his grave since 93. He was never put back to rest. Gil gets wigged out by rotting dead Billy just trotting around, but he does get Billy to agree to help him by way of a lie.
How long ago was 1993?
Wait, were you there that night with the Sanderson sisters?
Oh, unfortunately.
Well, guess what? They're back again.
Wait! I need your help! I'm doing a spell to kill Winifred!
For good. I mean, don't you want to pay her back for poisoning you and sewing your mouth shut?
So Billy's under the impression that he's trying to get rid of the witches, even though Gail is cursed into helping them. Meanwhile, the sisters are off to hunt down the mayor, and they end up at the festival.
They're drowning a man! How charming!
I like this festival!
Oh, look, he has an apple in his mouth. Perhaps they're going to roast him on a spit. My groomies would love this. Let me get the girls.
Beck and Izzy had been locked up in the basement of the magic shop by the witches, and they use magic to get set free from this basement. And they end up calling Cassie's dad because they're like, motherfucker, the witch is be after Cassie's dad. So we're going to rat Cassie out in order to get him away from the festival where the sisters are hunting him. At the festival, the sisters end up in a Sanderson sisters costume contest. They're eating up being worshipped. This is where we see the drag queens. Everyone's fabulous here.
Lose the teeth.
Mind your business, girl.
I really, really love that they incorporated some actual drag queens into this scene. The women, the Sanderson sisters, the originals is what they call themselves. They don't win, even though Sarah thinks they do, because of course Sarah still thinks that they do.
Oh, look, surprise.
The Sanderson!
Salem, we have come for the blood of thy mayor.
Oh, they're doing a bit. That's right, girls. Take all this blood.
With pleasure.
Woody starts to throw a fit and they sing again. They sing a spell to bewitch the festival goers. It's very Michael Jackson. What? It's very Michael Jackson Thriller to me. And they're kind of Michael Jacksoning, thrillering themselves around town to find the mayor. The sisters fly off to go peeping witch their way through people's homes looking for this guy. So when he sees one couple watching the OG Hocus Pocus, which is great. I love how there's some Easter eggs of the original movie in this film. This is one of them. So when she's peeping through this window, we see the scene. It's the guy handing out candy dressed in the devil costume. He's having this little squabble with his wife in the robe and the pink squiggle rollers.
Down, wooden face.
Shove it, Satan.
Mary peeps at a little kid and scares the candy out of him. Then we see the mayor walking back to the festival. He's broken up Cassie's party, but he's still determined to get this fucking candy apple. He is hyper fixated on it. Again, a very neurodivergent trait. Not diagnosing, just, you know, commenting. We see him notice some of the festival goers dressed as the devil guy costume and then said roller wife. I love that those two characters from the OG film are kind of like a standout in this reality. It just cracks me up. Meanwhile, Beckett and Izzy, they head to Cassie's, not realizing that the mayor would leave again. Dude really needs that damn apple, you know? They get to Cassie's, they're trying to knock on the door, and this is where they see Mike being chased by the witches down the street. So the witches, they weren't having any luck trying to find the mayor, so they were like, all right, who are we going to get to help us now? And for some reason, turned to the village idiot. They decided that Mike was the village idiot, and they scare him so much, he ends up taking them some... I'm not really clocking exactly their logic here, like how this would play out this way, but it is what it is, I guess. It also just pisses me off because he's not the village idiot, okay? Also, can we just not use that term? I don't care for it, right? He's not an idiot. He just processes things differently, and then his smarts come out in a different way that some people might perceive as to being an idiot, but he is not an idiot.
Oh my god, there's so many things to fucking say about this. I'm sorry. Am I though? No.
Anyways, Cassie's like, what the fuck should I let you guys in? Well, Becca and Izzy are trying to scream explain because there's witches trying to get at your dad. Anyways, the witches show up and they bust in. Whenever you die. Go, 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 go.
Spread out.
The girls run and hide. I don't know where Mike went, but the girls run and hide. Well, I think it's an Alexa home, whatever. I don't have one, so Google Home. I don't know what they're called or which one this is, but it turns on. It spooks the fuck out of Mary. And then Winnie.
Sorry, I didn't quite catch that.
What's that?
Winnie, there is a small woman trapped in that box.
No, yes.
I still don't understand. Is there something else I can do for you? Yeah!
They think there's a woman trapped in it. I also love when they first bust in the door and when he's like, all right, spread out. And Sarah just literally starts to spread out. I mean, she's taking things literally. Again, that can be a very neurodivergent thing to do. You're probably tired of me saying that. I don't care. Back at the festival, the mayor, he does finally get his candy apple, which he was sweating candy apple bullets, worried that he wasn't going to get one because he could tell that this booth, the woman who makes them, she was running out. But he ends up getting like maybe the last one. And when he turns around, he's so pleased with this shiny candy apple, la la la. And then all of the people who were bewitched by the witches to find him, they show up and he thinks it's a flash mob. Somehow in this moment, he also loses the candy apple. Like one of the mobsters takes it. I don't know, because it's just gone. And then they disperse because they have no further instructions. Once they find him, they find him. They point him out. That's it. But the witches aren't following them anymore because they were like, these guys are moving too fucking slow because they're just, again, Michael Jackson thrillering their way through town dancing to find this guy.
This is a flash mob.
You're in a flash mob. I watch these on TV all the time.
Well, you do.
I love them. I love it. Great.
Oh, I wish I knew the steps.
Hey. Wow. Hey, I got tons of steps, man.
What am I doing?
I got
here?
Tons of routine.
What
are we done? The choreo's out?
Here.
You guys should get an apple. That was well done. So where's my apple? Hey, whoa, 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 who's got my apple? Whoa. Hey,
Sandy, no, no, oh, come on, no, no! Ah!
We get a quick clip of Gil and Billy at the festival, the fair, whatever you want to call it. Carnival. It's a fast scene, but hilarious. Gil ends up leaving Billy at the carnival game he's playing because he wants to go check out how much time he has left per the witch's hourglass. So when the witches cursed him into helping them, they also had this magical hourglass. And when the hourglass runs out, I mean, his time is going to run out. So Gil's stressed over that and he leaves Billy at the carnival. At Cassie's house, they trap the witches in a salt circle. Winnie uses Sarah to test the strength of the salt circle by shoving her into the force field. Sarah just takes it. Winnie's so mean. I love her, but she's a bully. Billy decides that he's going to go catch up with Gil, who's at the magic shop. And when Billy sees the hourglass thing, he's like, "Aw, bitch, you mean you're actually helping the witches?" And he gets mad and tries to walk off. But Gil does end up managing to get Billy's head from him. Back with the girls, Mike is there too now, and they're resolving some shit.
"You would know if you'd have been there."
"Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't exactly feel welcome, you know, because you guys iced me out."
You ditched us."
"What are you talking about? I kept asking you guys to hang out and you would just flake or not respond."
"Because everything you wanted to do involved Mike and his friends."
"Yeah, it was like you suddenly had an entourage and we couldn't hang out with you without having to hang out with them." "I didn't know you guys were mad about that."
"How could you not know?"
"Because you didn't tell me."
"Cassie, why would we want to hang out with people that just make fun of us?"
"I don't make fun of you guys."
"Yeah, you call us witches and say that we're weird."
"Yeah, because you hang out in magic stores and always carry around colorful rocks. And I think it's weird, but I don't make fun of you guys."
"Do you hear yourself? Okay, pointing out people's differences and saying that they're weird is making fun of them."
"Whoa.
Did you, like, really not know that?"
"No. I thought I was just making conversation. I've got so many people to apologize to."
"It's okay."
Okay, I know I'm inserting myself too much into this, and I've definitely been on the side of things where Beck is coming from as far as the way I'm interpreting someone is saying something to me is not their intention. Okay. But she's just so self-righteous in the way that she's perceiving Mike that it irks me to my core. And Izzy in this moment too was kind of doing the same thing. Just listen to how Mike is talking, all right?
"Whoa.
Did you, like, really not know that?"
"No. I thought I was just making conversation. I've got so many people to apologize to."
From my perception, okay, and experience, and again, I know I'm inserting myself into this too much. I'm very passionate about it, and I'm kind of like, if this can be a learning opportunity, I'm going to take it. He thought he was humaning correctly in these social interactions that, again, are out of his comfort zone. It was his way of trying, and yeah, it didn't land, and yeah, I can see how it would come off as insensitive, but that legit wasn't his fucking intention. And he's even like, "God, I have so many people to apologize to." But the other side of things, they were just being mean girls back to him. And again, I know they're teenagers and there's a level of, you know, they're still learning and growing and brain development and blah, blah, blah. It just, they are very capable of learning and understanding. And I want them to learn and understand. I don't feel like this is resolved and it pisses me off a bit. Cassie's dad comes home and he finds the witches in the garage. You guys, he calls them the gothic golden girls.
"Grandmother says I'm in no mood. I have had an awful day. Do you know that? God knows what kind of unchaperoned house party you were throwing in there. And then I come home to, like, the gothic golden girls in my garage. What the heck?"
He's so fed up with this day that he's just over it and he does kind of stomp inside. The Roombas end up showing up and they let the sisters out of the salt trap. And then the witches snatch Cassie. So they're going to use her for the drop of blood that they need from the drop of an enemy's blood part of the spell that they need for their ingredients list. In the Forbidden Forest, Gil has assembled all the spell things, Billy's head and all. The witches blow in with Cassie. They call for Book, and this time it comes. Gil tries to get them to let Cassie go, but they're like, "Nah." And Winnie blasts Gil off to anywhere but there. They start chanting the spell, which they got to chant 7 whole fucking times, which they did get irritated about when they first were going over the spell. They were like, 7 times? Listen, I would get disinterested and be like, "No, I'm just going to move on." This fucking spell.
"I call upon the sacred land.
Itchitakapita Melica Mystica.
Raise the power in my hand.
Itchitakapita Melica Mystica.
North, east, the south, the west.
Itchitakapita Melica Mystica.
Give me more than I possess.
Itchitakapita Melica Mystica.
Underneath the full moonlight. I sacrifice my love tonight."
Also, I would never get it down because these words are straight sim mixed with Latin talk. Becca and Izzy show up and Becca's magic is showing.
"It's all in the Walgreens, the leaves in the basement, Cassie's house. 16th birthday. You're a witch.
Doesn't make any sense.
None of what's happened tonight makes any sense. Okay, look, I'm sorry to have to rush this very big, very pivotal moment in your life, but do you think we can use your magic to stop them and save Cassie?"
The spell's already working because Sarah discovers she's got this pink or fuchsia, whatever, lightning flying from her claws, and she's so thrilled about it. And then Mary's off to the side doing her finger guns. Maybe Mary is red, not blue. Where did I get blue from? Anyways, she's she's also like, oh shit, I can do that too. And she's doing the finger guns. She even like blows off the steam from him and like mimes pocketing her finger guns. It's hilarious. Mary is my favorite. I don't think I've said that yet, but Mary is my favorite out of the three sisters. I adore her. Becca ends up speaking directly to the book and tells it that it doesn't have to finish the spell, which the book wasn't down with this plan in the first place. It resisted. It tried really hard to show Winnie and Sarah and Mary the warning. There's two big ass warning pages of bitch, don't fucking do this. These are the repercussions. This is why you shouldn't. It came with clear instructions on why not to do this. But Winnie didn't give a fuck. She didn't even read the whole thing. And the book gave up and gave in to Winnie. So the book is smelling what Becca is stepping in. And it's like, you know what? You're right. And it goes to her. Winnie is like, the fuck, book? Fine. I don't need anyone. She's even like, I don't even need my sisters. And Sarah and Mary are like, dude, rude. They start to stand up for themselves for a second here, but then Winnie scares them back into submission, so they still do what she says.
Stop that! Stop dancing around, you fool! Get them! Get them! I beg your pardon?
I am not a fool. I am a good and loyal sister, and I expect to be seen as such!
Ooh, she let her down. She's a good and loyal sister.
Shut up and get going!
Of course, Winnie, with pleasure.
Go!
Post haste, as is your
wonder. I apologize for her.
The Power Maximus spell, it comes with consequences, right? That being what the spellcaster values the most, it essentially will take from them. Plus, in order for the spell to be at its best and actually fully work, the magic must be shared. And Winnie isn't so keen on sharing the power equally. She never really has been. First movie, this movie, Winnie, she needs her sisters, but she's still kind of all about herself, you know? But the girls understand that in order for them to be the most powerful and to come out of this, they got to work together. Even though Becca at first, she does kind of take a second to accept help from Izzy and Cassie, because at one point the witches, once Sarah and Mary, they've got their like lightning powers too. They do have to cast or recite the spell one more time, but again, the spell was already starting to work real well. So they haven't done the final incantation, but because Becca and Izzy and Cassie got the book from them, they're going after them, right? So Becca's able to create this kind of force field, and Izzy's like, remember, we have to work together for this to work. And she's hesitant at first, but she does end up taking Izzy's hand, who takes Cassie's hand, and they all create a solid force field. Whereas before, the witches were starting to break down this force field, but with their help and working together, they can't penetrate this force field. So Winnie and the sisters are like, fuck this, we don't need the book, we can do this on our own. And they go back and they finish the incantation, and it works, but we're gonna see at the expense of Sarah and Mary. So Becca and the girls, they do try to stop them from doing this final incantation, but they're too late. Becca says, you should have read the warning, because of course Winnie is dismissive. And that's when Sarah and Mary start to disappear.
Winnie, the wind stealing my fingers. Winnie!
Sisters!
It's over! Oh no! Oh, Winnie, please! Please don't forget us! Oh, and
I know. I know I was a favorite. Stop! Wait! With a ghost doll! Wait! Oh, please! Don't leave me!
Art thou not coming with us? Oh, fare thee well, my sisters!
Yes! Yes, and Winnie, sorrow is such sweet parting. Bye-bye.
Y'all, Winnie is heartbroken. Winnie begs the book to undo what she's done. She calls her sisters her passionate partners in unholy mischief. And from now until the end of eternity, I'm going to call my best of friends. If you're listening to this and you're my best of friend, who, you know, just neurodivergent, like-minded, listening to this in general, listen, if I ever have a Patreon, that I guess that needs to be a level, passionate partners in unholy mischief, because what a line, I love it. And then she says, my doing has been my undoing. I'm like, oh, Winnie, shit, you're learning a lesson here. I was not expecting that, but fuck, does she learn a lesson here? And she also ends up accepting this lesson, because Winnie is she begs the book to undo what she's done, right? She's pleading with it and with the girls. She's like, you're a coven, you can help me, book, please help me. And the book does end up taking pity on her, and it flips itself over in Becca's hands, and it turns itself open to a spell. We don't see what the spell is. And Becca's like, okay, we're going to help her. And the three of them recite the spell. Initially, Winnie's like, okay, thank you, but where are my sisters? And then we learn that the spell that's been cast isn't to bring her sisters back, but it's to send Winnie to her sisters. And at first, Winnie's kind of like, what? And then she goes, oh, how marvelous, as she starts to disappear.
Oh, how marvelous. Thank you. And how lucky art thou to have each other. Sister!
I do love the special effects here. The misty glimmer they swirl into, the wind on. It is like when he was saying, marvelous. Then Gil and Billy come back too late. Like, they bust out after the sisters are just gone. But it's hilarious. Gil and Billy's body come back. Billy calls himself a directionless skeleton sack. Big same, Billy.
Over here, you directionless skeleton sack.
Now, Billy Sparkle miss off to his own final rest. Gil apologizes to the girls, but still, I'm like, Gil, my dude, this be all on you. You made that fucking candle. You put your hard work into that fucking candle for a long ass time. And then you tricked them into lighting it. And I'm just gonna need a better apology than that.
Becca, I owe you an apology. Actually, I owe all of you an apology, you know, for everything.
You know what, Gilbert? It actually worked out pretty good.
He's like, discounts. Discounts for everyone. 20%. 10%.
Gilbert?
Some?
We'll see you at the shop?
Yes, you will. Discounts. Discounts.
Oh,
20% off. 10% off.
10%, Gil? Gilbert? We're going back to Gilbert because I think it's going to be shopping for free for them from now on, my dude. Basically, the end. We do see the blackbird with the flying monkey vest one more time. Then it's officially the end. Okay, so overall feelings on this movie. I do really like it. I am looking forward to probably on the day this is released, so it's Halloween. First of all, I don't think I said it yet. Happy Halloween, my witchy dears. I am looking forward to watching the first Hocus Pocus and then this one directly afterwards, have myself a little Hocus Pocus marathon. For me, I feel like it did a pretty good job capturing the quirkiness and the hilarity of the witches with the nostalgia of it all. I feel like there's something missing. I can't quite put my finger on what that is. Maybe it's more of the original cast. Maybe they were trying to hit it too on the nose with the musical interludes of it all. Or the songs just weren't quite the right fit. I'm not sure. But I think a lot of this was done really, really well. I loved seeing that it was much more inclusive. You know, the lead characters, they weren't all white. I mean, the witches are, but our new young witches are not. And then, I mean, just, you know, all around there was more inclusivity. If this wasn't more inclusive and, you know, less a sea of white faces, that would have been a problem for me. But I'm glad that they addressed that. The drag queens, while they were not in there too much, that was a fabulous addition, in my opinion. And it feels like it was left open for more sequels. I don't know how I feel about that. I don't know if I want to see this be a big franchise. I guess a part of me is still like, I don't want this to be poked at and prodded and drawn out too much. If there is another sequel, I would like to see more of the original cast. Of course, if possible. And the other thing is, when I was, I did read a little bit about, you know, the making of Hocus Pocus 2, and I didn't have the brain capacity in me to bring it all together as well as I would have liked to actually be able to put a proper episode out out with that information, but I did read a blurb about majority of the original cast, like the actor who played Max and then Allison. I don't think they were even reached out to for this sequel. And I think that would be because the way it was written, they just didn't write those characters into it. And maybe there were different versions where they were written into it. But I don't know. Again, I just feel like maybe that's what this is missing, but maybe I'm just missing the mark with that opinion. So either way, I know I don't rate films and I'm not trying to rate it right now, but I guess if I had to, I don't even want to give it like a number rating. I don't know. Number ratings feel weird to me and it's not my bag. It's pretty high up on a whatever scale you might be conjuring in your brain. I can't believe I actually got through watching it and then watching it twice to be able to talk about it. Snaps for me? I don't know. Anyways, guys, thanks for sticking around for this Hocus Pocus rendition Halloween episode. I appreciate you guys tremendously. Thank you for listening, especially when I go off on my tangents about neurodivergence, and whether it be about myself or, again, you know, in this case, during the movie, Mike. I know it all stems from my experience and whatnot, but when people are willing to listen and like really hear and take in what I'm saying, it just means a lot to me. And I don't say that in a pretentious way. It's just because a lot of people will glaze over or misconstrue, whether they're meaning to or not, talks about neurodivergence and the common misconceptions and the common use of neurodivergence to create characters like Mike or villains in movies and TV and books and stuff. And I get very passionate about it, and I think it's an important topic because it contributes to the misconception of what neurodivergence is, what it looks like, and it being more than, I guess, a kind of silly character like Mike or like the manic pixie dream girl of it all, like that kind of character, which is a whole other conversation. But yeah, I just, when people listen, I appreciate it. So if you're one of those people, just thank you. I genuinely, from the bottom of my little black heart, thank you. My next movie is Small Soldiers. Look for the trailer to that after the outro music. Don't forget to follow and subscribe wherever you listen so you can get a cute little alert when my next episode is available. See you later. Bye.
Oh, come on, it's just a bunch of hocus pocus.
Globotech Defense Systems. In a secret lab, the world's most advanced military microprocessor has been created. But the Cold War is over. For Globotech to survive, new markets must be found. Now, all that power has been placed into the brain of a fighting machine unlike any known to man. They made it strong. They made it clever. They made it small. They made a mistake.
Yeah. Commandos, attack!
I'm talking about toys that are so smart, when kids play with them, they play back.
Chip Hazard, reporting for duty.
You put munitions chips in toys?
Big action.
Oh my god, I'm having an aneurysm.
Big trouble.
Last chance, scum.
Oh yeah?
Medic!
Big movie.
They might be
defective. What are you packing, Tiny?
Packing you.
Small Soldiers.
You'd have to be crazy not to be scared.